Hey, I'm Robert Smith, and this is the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. This is where we take our favorite stories from the weekend and send them out to you for your listening pleasure. All right, coming up on this episode, we have our cover story, which is about the easiest way to become an American citizen. Go on, take a guess. It's not waiting in line. It's bringing a boatload of cash to invest and making it rain.
You may or may not get your money back, but you sure will get a green card out of this.
That's the cover story, buying citizenship. And then, my favorite story, this is if you have more time than money to spend. This is about how to prepare for a 10-hour-long musical.
There's been a lot of coffee.
Did you stretch?
I went for a long walk right before this.
The musical is called Life and Times, and it is hilarious, although it is 10 hours long. Also, we have two book interviews coming up I think you will enjoy. One is the story of some wild, crazy students who made millions playing poker. They call themselves the Hala Bala Crew.
In between throwing pieces of furniture off of a hotel window into the sea below, these kids are literally burning euros to light cigars.
And the second book is an amazing one. It is the story of one man who has been in prison for 38 years, swore he was innocent, and this author, Barry Siegel, tracks his attempts to get released from prison. And finally, best for last, New Orleans Bounce with Big Frida, the Queen Diva.
You know, lately they say Big Frida has the best dance party going on around the world right now, so I definitely want to leave that open for a lot of dancing.
All ahead on this podcast episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Smith. We are all familiar with the traditional immigrant story, leaving a tough life somewhere to find something better in the United States. Well, today, we tell the story of a very different kind of immigrant, those with lots of money to spare.
Yes, I was a barrister in the United Kingdom. Actually, I should say England and Wales. We had a vacation home here in Florida, and my wife and I and my two children, we came here frequently, and each time we left the nice weather of Florida, we were more and more depressed about having to leave.
Because Anthony Korda didn't like the London rain. And so he made a lifestyle choice. He was going to immigrate to the United States and live in a place where you can get a real tan. But Korda found out pretty quickly that the last thing the United States needs is more lawyers.
There are obviously professional visas. There are employment-based visas, but they are difficult to qualify for.
Korda could have waited in line for a regular visa. But then he saw something, a shortcut, really, to becoming an American. A small, obscure federal program designed for people like him to get into the country, if they had enough money.
Truthfully, it looked too good to be true. You know, the idea that you would pay somebody either $1 million or $500,000 and then be able to come and live here, it sounded to me at that time to be fanciful. So I did more research and realized that it actually was a genuine program.
All Korda had to do was cash out most of his savings, invest in an American business, and if he could help create 10 jobs, he would get a green card. And oh yeah, the investment that Korda picked?
It was a ski resort that already existed up in Vermont that was looking for funding to improve its infrastructure.
Korda plunked down his money, got to move to Florida, vacation in Vermont, and is on the road to citizenship. He got the American dream. But what did America get back in return? That's our cover story today, buying citizenship. The immigration program for the rich was designed to provide a boost to the U.S. economy. Makes sense. Bring in investment, real money from around the world to help businesses grow, create jobs. But try to figure out if it's actually working. Ask how many real permanent jobs were created, and nobody has good figures. First, let's show you how the program works. It's officially called an EB-5 visa. We let 10,000 people apply a year if they have the cash. Last year, 7,600 took us up on the offer. If you want to see the kind of places where the money goes, you can turn on your TV set when the Brooklyn Nets are playing hoops.
Yeah, I think this is going back to Joe Johnson.
4 seconds left. Double overtime. Nets looking for the win. Johnson, the step back. He buries it.
The team just moved to Brooklyn, and they needed a place to play. And the developer had a plan. Take a crummy neighborhood with abandoned railroad tracks, put in housing, offices, and that glorious new stadium for the Nets, Barclays Center. Bloomberg News reports that more than $200 million of the loans to build the project came from foreigners who were using the investment to get into the United States. The business plan predicts that in the end, it will create more than 5,000 jobs. That's how it's supposed to work. But often the projects funded by the EB-5 visas, they're not quite as glamorous. David North is with the Center for Immigration Studies, which often advocates for lower immigration levels. He says that the rules that the federal government set up for these visas encourage the investment in depressed areas, rural places, inner cities, places where private investment is scarce. But the result is these are often risky loans.
The investments that are open to an EB-5 investor are really rock-bottom marginal investments.
What do you mean rock-bottom marginal investments? It's not, well, it's not the IBMs, it's not the gold star companies?
Well, it certainly is not that. It's none of the above. These are essentially small, usually real estate investments of some kind, small construction investments.
North says one of the other problems with the rules is that the investor, the one who wants to move to the United States, has very few responsibilities to make sure the project works in the end.
We're not bringing entrepreneurs to this country in this program. We're bringing passive investors. Now, I was retained by the Australian Embassy at one point, and they demanded that you speak English, that you be relatively young, that you run a company, and you put in some money, okay? We don't do any of those things. All we care about is just the money, and we don't care whether they start a business or they just sign a check.
The federal government doesn't release numbers to tell us how many of these investments succeed or fail. Dune Lawrence, an investigative reporter with Bloomberg News, spent months trying to figure it out.
The basic problem starts with the fact that it's an economic development program run by an immigration agency, and the immigration agency is focused on immigration. So their big concern is sort of handling the applications from each immigrant, and this whole economic development side of it has grown up that I think they're pretty unprepared to handle.
So as an investigative reporter, you're looking to see this basic question: how's the economic side of this working? You know, is it in fact, you know, creating jobs? Is it in fact creating successful businesses? What data was available to you? There's not an end of the year annual report that the immigration agency puts out that says we were good or we weren't.
You know, they'll tell you how many of these immigrant investors actually got the green card, which would imply that their money was spent properly and created the proper number of jobs. But there's literally no one going out and saying, oh, this actually happened, or this has actually created any jobs. I mean, it's all based on the economic assumptions that were made at the beginning of the project. And if they can show that they're in the process of spending the money, then that's that.
Yeah. So in your research, because there's not any official way to do this, you did something very smart. You went out and looked for lawsuits, which, of course, tells you what went wrong. What is the worst case scenario? And you mentioned the South Dakota dairy farm. There's just nothing more American to me than a South Dakota dairy farm. Explain to me what the plan was.
This involved Chinese investors. In that lawsuit, it seemed to come down to a dispute with the agent. The agent who had gone and solicited these Chinese investors wanted more money. And that was my understanding, that there was a dispute over the fee. And so the agent then, and this gives you a sense of how little the investors in these projects understand, the agent was then going back to the Chinese investors and saying, look, you've totally been duped. You got to sue this guy. He didn't tell you what was going on. And if you're a Chinese person, and all you want to do is buy a visa and move to the United States so your kids can get an education here, you don't have the means, likely, to really understand all that, especially if you're going through all these layers. You've got the agent who recruited you, and then their international office somewhere, and then the regional center, and then the immigration authority in the U.S. I mean, it's a really confusing process.
And there's no information on what's working and what's not.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a complex process. Something called the North American Securities Administrators Association, they put EB-5 investment scams as one of their top five new threats to investors. That's not so good. Not a good sign for the program.
That's Dune Lawrence, an investigative reporter with Bloomberg News. Despite all the questions, defenders of the program say, look, money is money. Maybe some rich foreigners could lose their stake. Maybe some won't create the right number of jobs. Maybe a lot of the projects don't make sense. But it is a real, if relatively tiny, bump in investment. Mark Jones is a political science professor at the Baker Institute at Rice University in Texas.
Overall, I think it's good for the economy because it is bringing in money to the United States and bringing in investment to the United States that may not otherwise have come here. People who are overall making a contribution to the United States, both directly via these investments, but as well through other spending once they actually arrive here.
You know, if you weren't talking about investment, you were talking about gambling. There's a word for this in Las Vegas. They're whales.
Well, in many ways, they are whales. And just like with Las Vegas, you have competition from Atlantic City, casinos in the New Orleans and elsewhere in Louisiana. There's a lot of competition for these investors. The United States isn't the only country that's trying to lure them with the promise of some type of residency status. The United Kingdom does it. New Zealand does it. Canada does it. The Bahamas does it. In the Bahamas, it's a lot easier because there all you have to do is build a $1.5 million house and you're done.
So if the U.S. reaches the cap, if they end up giving away or selling, depending on how you want to look at it, the 10,000 visas, then is there a possibility that they could just make more of them?
It would require new legislation or at least an amendment to the existing legislation by Congress, say raising the cap from 10,000 to 15, at which time they may also raise the price. So there are sort of two ways Congress could address this. One is to raise the amount of visas, say from 10,000 to 15. The other is to raise the minimum amount from 500,000 to 1 million or 1.5 million. I think either of those options would reduce the numbers below 10,000.
But there's a political problem about expanding this program, isn't there? I mean, for a lot of people, this looks bad. It feels bad to be essentially selling U.S. citizenship.
I think this legislation was passed in a different political climate related to immigration back in 1990. It would be a tougher sell today unless it was put as part of a broader comprehensive immigration reform, in which case it may disappear into the weeds in terms of being a relatively minor component of a much broader type reform.
That's Mark Jones from Rice University. He says just as you can find anecdotal evidence of failure, you can find a bunch of examples of successful projects funded with these kind of visas. In Texas, he's looked at strip malls, horse racing enterprises, even real estate projects that were funded by immigrants that seemed to be working. But what about Anthony Korda? He's the British lawyer who wanted to live by the beach. He invested $500,000 in a ski resort to get his visa. So how did it work out?
It's been a fairly modest return on investment. I would say maybe over the 6 years that we've been invested, we've maybe had about 1.5% to 2% back.
Okay, Korda could have done much better in the stock market or bonds. But then he would have been living in the gloom of London instead of on the beach in Florida where he wants to be.
It's a trade-off. I mean, this is why I say in answer to the critics, you have to be able to offer these investors something in return because they are investing in industries that the banks don't want to invest in, that you know, U.S. investors may not be looking at as a great rate of return. You're certainly not going to find investors at the $500,000 or $1 million level who are going to be satisfied with between 0 and 1 or 2%. And who are going to have their money tied up for an indefinite period.
By the way, Korda has found another way to make that initial investment pay off. As a lawyer, he now consults with other wealthy foreigners wanting to use the program to come to America. This past week, one of our producers read a story in the Los Angeles Times that seemed almost like a movie pitch. Fade in, interior, California, early 1980s. Mike Williams is an inventor without an invention. A cracked tooth has sent him to the dentist's office, and he asks if he can see it.
Don't you have any cameras or anything to really show people their teeth? And he goes, no, we don't need that. We've got a mirror. And I'm going, well, how are you going to show me my teeth then? And he goes, you know what, Mike? That's an excellent idea.
Eureka. Mike Williams set about inventing the first intraoral camera, and it was a big success. From there, he formed a company and sold it.
For about $1 million.
Other medical inventions followed.
And from there, my career took off. One day, David Letterman called me and said, I just read about your little camera. Can you come on down to Rockefeller Center in New York and bring your cameras to the studios and set them up?
Ladies and gentlemen, tonight, for the first time anywhere, the late night Monkey Cam mobile unit, Zippy.
I forgot about the monkey cam. The monkey cam was amazing.
Yep.
ladies and gentlemen, I think it's easy to see that this technology has limitless applications.
Mike Williams was successful, appreciated, in demand. But just like in a movie, it wouldn't last. Jump cut to the 2000s.
The real estate market destroyed a lot of my financial capabilities, and my home went into foreclosure. I had a group that defrauded me in Florida, took about $2.5 million from me in a scam. And it just kept going and kept going, and I couldn't stop it. Just everything crumbled, and then my wife asked for a divorce. And when she asked for a divorce, I packed my car and told my kids to come and get what they wanted, and I basically hit the streets.
Mike Williams, successful inventor, was now homeless. For a while, he lived out of his car, kept a journal on a laptop. But once he fell behind on his car payments, he took shelter in a dumpster.
I found out that I was really nothing, and that was very hard for me to grasp. The fact that nobody wanted me around, they really didn't want me sleeping next to their cars or in their backyards or out in the parks, that I was something nobody wanted to see or to even be involved in. And that crushed me.
And I understand that one night you were sleeping in a park, and tell me the story.
Well, this particular night I was roaming the streets of Sacramento, and down on the Capital City State Mall, there's a very large rose garden there. And I thought, man, this would really be a nice place to just hang out. So I hid underneath the fountain of the rose garden. I had my laptop in a bag. And about 1 o'clock in the morning, I was woken up with two guys that were kicking me and trying to pull me out and grabbing me. And I fought as best I could, but they kicked me so hard that I passed out. They gave me severe hernias and destroyed my prostate. And I laid there. I just laid there and cried. And, of course, I lost my laptop. I lost all my notes and all my pictures from the streets and whatever. I got up, and I walked to Sutter Emergency Room. And I waited there for 19 hours. I was a homeless guy. Didn't look too good. Didn't smell too good. And in a lot of pain and no insurance. And finally, they took me in. And little did I know that that beating was truly the beating that changed my life.
It changed his life because Mike Williams' injury would eventually lead him to Dr. Zhong Chen.
He came into my office, complained of the pain in the lower abdomen.
Before Dr. Chen performed surgery on Williams' damaged prostate, the two struck up a conversation.
He asked me, he says, well, what did you do with your life? How did you become homeless? And I started telling him the story, and I said, as a matter of fact, I'm the inventor of that little wire catheter that you're using.
And I asked him his education background. I said, well, what a waste, this gentleman, you know, walking on the street.
What a waste. Dr. Chen saw a way to help Mike Williams get off the street.
And he called me at the shelter one day, and he asked me out for breakfast.
He almost cried, you know. I said, oh, go ahead. It'll be on me.
And he said, I want you to bring your patents. I want you to bring whatever you're working on. And so he picked me up. We went to McDonald's and said, well, what are you doing now? What's your new invention? And I told him, I want to invent, for the first time, a secure, safe place for homeless people and people that are displaced in our society. I want to give them a safe place to live.
Mike Williams came up with this idea while resting in one of the only safe places he could find, a dumpster. He'd drawn up plans for a self-contained survival pod.
It's 6 feet wide, 6 feet tall. It's got a single bed in it. It's got a chemical toilet.
And Dr. Chen signed on. He agreed to form a company with Mike Williams and start creating a prototype pod. They envision other applications, too. FEMA could use these shelters for emergency housing. Airports could rent them to travelers with long layovers. And it all got started with an unusually generous contribution.
To me, a patient is a patient. No matter what kind of status you have, they need the help. We can give him the help.
Dr. Chen not only took me out of the shelter, he took me downtown and got me a really nice apartment. He took me to Macy's and bought me all new clothes, a whole new wardrobe. He still treats me for free. He just can't do enough. Truly an amazing, amazing man.
So, Mr. Williams, this is an amazing opportunity. Very few people get even the first chance that you got to invent something and build a company around it. You've been given another chance with a new business partner, a new idea, a new start on life. How do you personally change the way you approach the world?
With humility and prayer every day.
You weren't humble before?
I was humble, but I was rich. And I think that's probably what the problem is with our leaders, is that once you have a separation of class and you're rich, you can be humble, you can say all the right things, you can pretend like you care. But are these people really the ones that are pulling people out of the streets, giving them a second chance, giving them a job, loving them the way Dr. Chen loved me, because they're rich? And I'm just telling you that Dr. Chen is the example for America.
That's inventor Mike Williams, who, along with Dr. Zhang Chen, is developing a portable housing pod for the homeless. Hey, thanks for sticking with us. It's Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Robert Smith. Opening this week in New York City, you can see a musical that demands a little something extra from its audience. Endurance. The show is called Life and Times, and it is more than 10 hours from start to finish. It's a production of Soho Rep at the Public Theater, and before the musical starts, the audience has that focus that you only see in marathon runners preparing for the long haul. I notice you are furiously shoving sushi into your mouth because this is going to be a long performance.
Yes. There's been a lot of coffee.
Did you stretch?
I went for a long walk right before this.
The lines for the restrooms go around the corner. Nobody was quite sure if...
We're getting breaks, right? To use the bathroom?
Yeah, you get breaks. So what epic tale could take more than 10 hours to tell? Henry V? The Bible? Not quite. Life and Times is the story of one average woman's life. The creators of the musical called her on the phone a few years ago, out of the blue, and they said, tell me your life story, all of it, from the very beginning. And they recorded every stutter, every false start.
So, shall I start? Okay.
And that, right there, that's the script.
So, shall I start? Okay.
One cast member after another picks up the remembrance.
Let's see. Oh, yes. Oh, and I do remember.
And once the words finally start flowing, we are inside the memories of Kristen Worrell, child of suburban Providence, Rhode Island.
And they didn't expect me. They planned both my brother and sister before me. And so my mother says that she was very happy that I was a girl, and she was like, you were so beautiful. And I didn't cry a lot, I don't think. I was very peaceful.
We hear about first grade teachers, art projects, a very dramatic dance class. But even the cast admits at one point,
Goddess must be so boring for you.
And yes, yes, it can sometimes be mind-crushingly dull.
I'm sorry.
Surprisingly, most of the time, no apology is needed. The stories are hilarious, and the language is addictive. It's like listening in on someone's secret thoughts. Pavel Liska is the co-creator of the work. His company is called the Nature Theater of Oklahoma. And Pavel says he never intended this to be quite the epic it turned out to be.
Originally, I was going to talk to several people and ask them to tell me their life story and compile one project out of multiple stories.
Pavel wasn't interested in any particular story, but the way we tell stories, the rhythm of, you know, how we, like, speak today. Kristen Worrell just happened to be first on Pavel's list. She says he didn't tell her at first what the project was really about.
I assumed I was going to, you know, just be edited with a bunch of other people, and it was going to be a montage, and I'd be anonymous. So, yes, I was completely speaking off the cuff and, you know, telling him about 17 crushes I had in elementary school. I mean, who cares about this stuff?
Turns out Pavel did. At the end of a 2-hour phone call, they had only made it up to year 8 of her life. So he called her back over and over, recording each time. Pavel and his co-creator Kelly Copper say what they loved about Kristen's life was the exact opposite of what Hollywood looks for. It was fairly unremarkable, no major trauma, no life-altering romance, no explosions. It's life as most of us remember.
What we were interested in is to take something that's not art at all, that's not even close to art, and beat our heads against the wall to figure out how the hell do we make this into art.
And in a way, music is the most formally challenging thing you could do to it. It's the least realistic.
And everyone, like, sort of acknowledged that I was, like, the smartest kid in the class. And I really wanted to maintain that status. apparatus and
And I don't really remember much from fourth grade.
The music gets more complex. A disco beat hits as Kristen enters adolescence. We get first kisses, sneaking cigarettes, heartbreak at the school dance. All these trivial stories start to add up, though. They start to become a moving portrait of how serious everything seemed when we were teenagers. The musical started at 2 in the afternoon. There are a couple breaks. Cast serves dinner, dessert. It is almost midnight when Kristen gets through high school. And there it ends, with the ominous words, "to be continued." I asked Pavel Liska, as enjoyable as this all is, did it really have to be this much of a marathon? He said he thinks of it like going to the gym.
You're not going to go to a gym and get a good workout if somehow you're not sweating and have been a little bit of pain afterwards. This is the same thing to me. It's a total body workout, even for your body. You know,
yeah,
it's
I have a workout. My back hurt a little bit after
it's
this.
It's a workout for your body. You know, I feel like I want that for myself.
Pavel Liska is the director, along with Kelly Copper, of Life and Times. If you are weak of fortitude, I suggest watching it in shorter sections. They do offer that option. The marathon sessions go on Saturdays. In fact, they're all trapped there right now as we speak, probably somewhere around eighth grade.
During that song, I walked. I was about to walk up to Matt Wolf, and I was like just about to like tap him on his shoulder. And then he went and asked Jennifer Wilkes to go dance with him.
Every era has its seemingly surefire way for a young person to get rich quick. In the 80s, you went to Wall Street. In the late 90s, you could join a dot-com firm. In the aughts, after the year 2000, the dream for greedy college students everywhere was to flop a full boat against a made flush. I'm referring here to poker, of course, specifically online poker. And for a few years, it was a national obsession on college campuses. People lost a lot of money, but a few, often young, social misfits, they made a killing. They used their brains and some introductory statistics courses to make millions. Jonathan Grotenstein is an author who followed a crew of these young people, and I feel like I should yell the title of your book.
It certainly sounds better when it's yelled.
Yeah, do it.
Ship It Holla, Ballas.
Oh, I like you put the comma in there, too. Ship It Holla, Ballas. And what does this mean? Break it down for us, this slang.
It is a combination of three different terms. The first part, ship it, is an expression that you'll hear at the poker table often, generally to express your pleasure when the chips are moving your way. Ship me that pot, ship it to me. Holla is
a traditional greeting among young people.
Yes, among old people, too. It actually came out of Shakespeare, but that was sort of latched on as a way of saying, you know, right on when somebody said ship it. So ship it, holla. A balla was sort of urban parlance for someone who was very good at basketball, but has sort of grown to mean someone who's good at anything. So these kids were the Ship It Holla Ballas, a name that they chose both to separate themselves from the old farts who were already playing poker, and kind of an inside joke for themselves to seem a little bit more arrogant and maybe a little more extroverted than they actually were.
Yeah, I feel like a square just explaining this stuff.
Me too.
So you and your co-author followed a group of young people who decided to forego college. They decided they didn't want to get a job. They decided they wanted to play online poker and make millions. And you described them as the loudest, craziest, and richest crew in poker. Tell me about a few of them.
Well, our book mostly concentrates on two of the kids. One of them was a high school athlete whose pitching career was cut short by a separated shoulder and kind of turned to poker as a way, an outlet for that same kind of competitive energy that he had used on the baseball field. The name that he chose for himself was Raptor, which had originally been the name that he used on AOL's Instant Messenger. The other kid that we follow was named Good to See You. Good to See You was a kid from Michigan who grew up in a family that was kind of dissipating around him. His parents were going through a divorce and was also suffering from kind of the typical awkward teenage stuff that a lot of kids go through. Acne, trying to fit in, trying to find a girlfriend, loving computer games a lot more than he loved his schoolwork. And poker seemed like a dream for him, a chance to become the kind of, you know, cool rock star slash poker player that he was seeing on TV.
So over the course of the book, you follow Raptor and Good to See You as they make enormous sums of money, Were they geniuses?
Geniuses is a tough term to apply to these kids. They were highly intelligent. I'm not sure that either kid would qualify as a genius in any sort of traditional sense.
So what gave them the edge?
Timing, more than anything else. Nobody was yet treating the internet as a completely different way of playing the game. So they turned to a site called 2+2, which was a message board slash kind of clearinghouse for information about poker that was shared by a hive mind, a community of people who are really thinking about the game. And when they stumbled into the area that was dedicated to these tournaments called Sit and Goes, they discovered that a lot of people claimed they were almost literally minting money at Sit and Goes, that they were looking at the game in terms of how much am I going to win today, as opposed to, I wonder if I'm going to be able to beat this game.
Well, there was something else about their timing. Not only were they there when internet poker just started out, but this was also a moment when poker in general sort of entered the popular consciousness. 2003, there was an event that these young people looked at as sort of transformative.
Yes, in 2003, a guy named Chris Moneymaker, who was sort of, you know, the American everyman. He was an accountant from Tennessee who had won his way into the World Series of Poker in a $27 tournament that eventually got him onto poker's biggest stage.
This is the World Series of Poker. Chris Moneymaker going all in with nothing.
A stunning play from Moneymaker.
When Moneymaker beat a very well-known professional player named Sammy Farha on national TV, it kind of set the world on fire.
And considering this situation, I know we're early in the century, but that's the bluff of the century.
Suddenly everybody realized that, you know, they could be the next Chris Moneymaker. And online poker seemed to be the path to getting there.
You know, you have this great moment in the book where Good to See You, who is a college student at the time, talks to his father about quitting college to play poker. And it reminded me of every moment at which a young person says, no, you don't understand. The world is changing. I have a way to make money you may not approve of.
Yes, that was exactly what it was. And to Good to See You's father's credit, he understood. He didn't necessarily approve, but realized that his son had developed these dreams sitting on the couch watching the World Series of Poker with him. And to sort of make his case, Good to See You showed his father all of the meticulous records he had kept on his poker playing.
He had spreadsheets like showing how much he was winning and losing every day with each game, his strategies, how many games he could play at the same time. I mean, he was running this like a business, playing online poker.
That's exactly right. What sort of united all of these kids is that they all treated poker like a business. When they talked about winning at the poker table, they didn't talk about it in terms of, hey, I won this much today, but in terms of return on investment. If I invest this much time and this much money into a game, I can expect to see this kind of rate of return on that particular investment.
And, you know, if they had been 30, 35, 40 years old, they would have been sober, smart businessmen, but they were not. They were 18, 19, 20 years old, making a ton of money, and they acted like adolescents, true?
Yes. There is a scene in our book where in between throwing pieces of furniture off of a Mediterranean hotel window into the sea below, these kids are literally burning euros to light cigars.
Yeah, well, people may have noticed that we're talking about this in the past tense. This was a limited era, the online poker playing era. What happened?
It lasted almost exactly 10 years. The United States government cracked down originally in 2008 with a set of laws that were tacked on to a Homeland Security bill that essentially outlawed online poker. And by the year 2010, online poker was effectively shut down in the United States, and these kids were all forced to find something else to do with their time.
So where did these kids that we follow in this book, where did they go?
Some of them went back to school. Some of them went back home and found real jobs and family businesses. Some of them were able to hold on to some of their money and use that to fund startup companies or do other things. And some of them decided that they had at this point become legitimate poker players and were ready to compete in the biggest games in the world and are still playing in those games and succeeding at those games.
Jonathan Grotenstein is one of the authors of Ship It Hala Balas. Jonathan, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robert.
In 1962, a school bus full of kids spotted a mysterious crime scene in the Arizona desert. An abandoned car, a man and a woman shot in the head, and police were baffled. The case went unsolved for a decade, stone cold, until they arrested a man that no one would have suspected, a man who swore he was innocent, Bill McCumber.
He was a pillar of his community, married, three young sons, no criminal record, not even that proverbial traffic ticket. Not just a spotless record, he was one of the most admired and revered people in his community.
That's Barry Siegel. He's the author of a new book about the McCumber case called Manifest Injustice. The injustice in the title refers to something that the jury in Bill McCumber's trial never learned. Someone else had confessed to this crime. A sociopath named Ernest Valenzuela told his lawyer, "I committed those murders. I killed that couple." But the lawyer couldn't say anything. Attorney-client privilege. And Valenzuela couldn't say anything because he died in jail.
The law says that a dead client's right, attorney-client privilege, trumps the rights of a defendant in a murder trial.
Nobody could help Bill McCumber. The man who did not admit to the crime went to jail for life. And author Barry Siegel says this was one of those cases where there wasn't enough evidence to prove McCumber's innocence.
They didn't use DNA in evidence back the time he was arrested, of course, but you could have still gone to the physical evidence now and tested it for DNA, except for the fact that all the physical evidence in McCumber's trial was ordered destroyed a few years after his conviction, just as a matter of housekeeping in Maricopa County.
So let's go forward 21 years later. Bill McCumber's been in prison for 2 decades, and by all accounts, he is a model prisoner. He is in the local JCs. He's sort of a legend in prison, but mostly forgotten about outside of prison. So 21 years later, what happens?
Tom O'Toole was the lawyer who heard Ernest Valenzuela's confession to the murders way, way back in the 1960s. He had always been haunted by the case, always been haunted by his inability to get up and testify about what he had heard. So in 1998, he picked up the phone and called Larry Hammond, the founding director of the Arizona Justice Project, told Larry Hammond, "I heard the confession of the true killer in the McCumber case. McCumber is innocent. You need to take up his case." And that's how the Arizona Justice Project entered the case.
Now, this book was going to have an unhappy ending. The Justice Project tried a couple of times to introduce new evidence to get Bill McCumber out of jail. And for various legal reasons and politics, they never managed to do it. You were set, really, to end this book with a man who says he's innocent spending the rest of his life in prison.
I just wanted to see the insides of this case. I wanted to use this story as a window onto the legal system. And a Hollywood ending, it doesn't happen that often in the legal system. And so I was satisfied to just be able to tell the story of this case, however it ended.
And then?
And then, the most remarkable turn of events. A couple months ago, I had actually finished writing my book. Bill McCumber had tried one last clemency hearing, hadn't succeeded. Then they finally were able to file the petition for post-conviction relief that they had never been able to complete because they just didn't have the right assembly of evidence. And lo and behold, it went to a sympathetic judge. Out of the blue, he granted an evidentiary hearing. That put pressure on the Maricopa County Prosecutor's Office. If Bill got a new trial, they would never be able to prosecute him because all the evidence had been destroyed. Suddenly, the state wanted to bargain. In early November last year, I flew out to Phoenix to see one of the most remarkable moments of my life. Bill McCumber was brought into the courtroom. He was allowed to plead no contest, and for that, he was released. I watched as the guards unlocked the cuffs, the shackles, the chains, and Bill walked free out of the courtroom. 38 years in prison, 77 years old. Never thought I'd see that day.
Joining us now is Bill McCumber, who is speaking to us from his home. That must feel good to be able to say you're speaking to us from your home.
Most certainly.
Describe what you see outside your home right now. You have picked a place as different as possible from prison.
Well, I'm approximately 5 miles south of the Colorado line in New Mexico, and I'm looking out the kitchen window at the moment. I'm looking across a valley filled with juniper and cedar trees to a range of mountains over about 10 miles away. Snow on the slopes, snow on the ground, and no barbed wire or no wire of any kind interfering with the view.
Now, you were allowed out of prison in the end by pleading no contest. And no contest is a term of technical art, which means that in the eyes of the law, they can still consider you guilty, but you did not admit guilt. How did you decide in your own head that this was the best way to go?
Had I not had any family to consider, if I had only considered myself, I would have never entered the no contest plea. I would have followed the post-conviction relief through to its end, whatever that end might have been.
So you would have died in prison?
I could have, yes. But I did have a family to consider. I had a family who had endured the same thing I had endured for 38 years. I, through the no contest plea, had the option then of spending whatever time I have left with my family, particularly my children, my grandchildren, and my great-grandchildren. So it was not really an option. It was something that I could not take advantage of.
It seemed like in the end, your story really, really showed each and every flaw in the U.S. justice system from the beginning when you were convicted to the end when you got out, but even got out sort of on this strange, almost technical decision.
Our justice system is severely flawed. There's not liberty and justice for all. There's liberty and justice for those that can afford it. But for the average man, there's no guarantee they're going to get it. All of the legal assistance that I received over the last 12 years since the Justice Project became involved, if it was totaled up, we'd be talking millions and millions and millions of dollars. And it would have been totally impossible to do that had it not been for the gracious efforts of the Justice Project, of the volunteers. It just would not have been possible. That's all there is to it.
So do you feel bitterness about this whole process?
No, no. Bitterness is for fools. Bitterness, vengeance, all of that. There's no saving grace in those things. What I'm doing is looking ahead down the road. I don't look back. It doesn't produce any positive results.
Bill McCumber, now free from prison, is the subject of the new book, Manifest Injustice, written by Barry Siegel, whom we heard from a bit earlier. Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Robert, for your interest.
And what are you going to do with the rest of today?
I'm working on a little story for my great-granddaughters. I'm going to finish that up. Then we'll just see what the day brings.
Wow, an unpredictable day. That's a nice change.
Yes, it is.
On this show, we've been asking filmmakers about the movies they never get tired of watching, the ones they could watch over and over again, including this one from the star of the film, Basquiat.
This is the end, beautiful friend.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey Wright, and I'm an actor. And the film that I've seen a million times is Apocalypse Now, directed by Francis Ford Coppola, starring Martin Sheen, Marlon Brando, Albert Hall, Larry Fishburne, Robert Duvall, and God knows all of the other greatest actors in the world giving some of the greatest portrayals ever seen in cinema. I guess I was maybe 16 or 17 when I first saw it. And, you know, for, you know, teenager, you know, becoming a man, there's, I think, to some extent, a kind of natural fascination with conflict and war for young men. And so this movie, in some ways, was kind of the closest that, you know, I had to a war experience.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
It's the story of, you know, a young soldier who's given a mission, and he goes on an epic, you know, hero's journey through madness and horror. To choose one scene, why don't I just keep it simple and just start with the beginning, when we find, you know, Martin Sheen, you know, Captain Willard, lying in bed in Saigon, and the journey begins.
Everyone gets everything he wants. I wanted a mission, and for my sins, they gave me one. Brought it up to me like room service.
And probably features the most effective narration of any film in the history of cinema.
It was a real choice mission.
The end of this thing, we find, you know, Marlon Brando in just one of the most powerful, strange, kind of wonderfully indulgent performances imaginable. You know, he says, asks Martin Sheen, you know, are you an assassin?
Are you an assassin? I'm a soldier.
His face peers out finally into the light and he says, you're neither.
You're an errand boy.
Sent by
grocery clerks.
Grocery clerks, he says.
To collect a bill.
To collect a bill, you know, and it's just this staggering poetry. It's just magic.
Horror.
The first movie I ever did was a miniseries called Separate But Equal with Sidney Poitier and Albert Hall, who played Chief in Apocalypse Now. And I said, Albert, oh man, you know, I've seen Apocalypse Now, I don't know, probably 163 times, and it's just the most meaningful thing to me. And when we finished filming, he gave me a book, and he wrote inside, Jeffrey, evolution is when a young actor comes up to you and says, I've seen your work, you know, 100 so times, and it has meaning to me. And it was, I don't know, that's just kind of an antidote of what the film meant to me.
That's actor Jeffrey Wright talking about the movie that he could watch a million times, Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now. Wright's new film, Broken City, is in theaters now. And now, time for some music.
Big Frida coming one more time! Big Frida coming one more time!
My name is Big Frida the Queen Diva. I'm a bounce artist, straight, born and raised from New Orleans, Louisiana. And I love what I do.
And what she does is to roll into a town, set up at a club, and drive the audience wild. You can't just listen to Big Frida. You have to be there to experience Big Frida.
Just get out there, get sweaty, get dirty, dance.
Bootylicious, shaking everything, everywhere, everybody.
We're an older group. This is what we call working your body.
I did what was called a handstand. What you do is get on your hands, you put both legs in there, and you just shake until you fall down.
There has been so much discussion here at Weekend, All Things Considered, about how to refer exactly to the thing which you shake. And we know we're a family-friendly program, so there's many different words we can use.
I would say booty shaking.
Okay.
How'd that sound?
Booty? Behind? Or is that like, does that make me sound like a square?
Yeah, definitely.
You're looking at me.
You
like,
don't.
Like,
you
this
like,
is the worst thing ever.
You come shake your booty. Come shake your rump shaker.
All right. Okay, now that we've settled the matter of terminology, let me tell you a little bit about Big Frida. Big Frida's name during the day is Freddie Ross, when he is an interior decorator. But at night, he is a she, Big Frida. And that's how she arrived at our studios. 6 foot something, hair down her back, earrings. Big Frida is the queen of bounce music. Describe to me bounce music. It's more than just the sound, right?
My definition of bounce music is an up-tempo, heavy bass, call-and-response type music. It's strictly in born and raised out of New Orleans, and they love it. Like, they listen to it morning, noon, and night. It has a lot to deal with dancing as well, call-and-respond, you know, where if I would say, I got that gin in my system, and then the crowd would say, somebody gonna be my victim.
Now, the lyrics are pretty simple, but that's intentional, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Why? Because you want to leave room for the bass?
You got to leave room for the bass and the boom and the knock, and just for people to be able to just free themselves and express themselves through dance. You know, lately they say Big Frida has the best dance party going on around the world right now, so I definitely want to leave that open for a lot of dancing.
So, describe to me the history of bounce music.
It started about 2 decades ago, 2 DJs out of New Orleans, and they started like colliding these 2 beats, which was the Trigger Man beat by the Showboys and the Brown beat. And the Trigger Man is that, dum, da, dum, dum.
The rhymes you are about to hear are true. MC's names have been changed to protect the innocent.
when you would hear that come on, everybody in the whole club just rocking and jumping. I would be at middle school dances, high school dances, and that would be something that was very epic to the sound when they would put on the Showboys or the Derrick B. Brown beat. And we use those beats in just a lot of our music, and we know how to flip it a million and one ways, and the producers, they know what to do with it to make the crowd jump. About 1998, my best friend Katie Redd was the first transsexual male to come out with Bounce Music. And I backgrounded Katie for about 2 years. And then that's when the game totally switched when me and Katie jumped in it. And yeah, we messed their heads up big time.
Wait, why? New Orleans has a rich gay culture. Why was it unusual for two gay guys to be doing Bounce Music?
Because it was a new music, you know, a new sound. And New Orleans does have a very rich gay culture, but that was something new for everybody.
Who that the right there? Catching them as well just to make you stare. Ladies in the club just swinging their hair. Moving to the beat, shaking that derriere.
When you're up on stage, when you do the Bounce Music, there is a particular kind of dance that goes with this. So describe the scene to me. Like, what does it look like?
Well, you have a lot of butt shaking going on. You know, definitely on stage. You have guys on stage doing the shoulder hustle where you're like kind of moving your shoulders and you're like moving them side to side and you're making them jump up and down and you're moving your arms with it and your legs. That's kind of what the fellas do. The girls kind of, you know, hands on the floor, butt in the air, bent over, shaking up and down like a basketball. You know, kind of round in a circle like a mixing bowl. You know, so they do a little different. They swiggle their bodies a little different like a snake while they're dancing. We go in all different kind of ways. Everyone is unique to the way that they dance in New Orleans.
You actually bring dancers with you. Like, you say this is how it's supposed to look.
Right. I have my divas and I have my dudes. That's the Big Frida team. And we definitely have to show them exactly how I go. And, you know, in some of the cities that I go to, I offer my dance class that I, you know, do before the show. The video is coming soon, too. Workout video.
Is it a workout video or this is the way you have to prepare to go to your show?
Well, it's going to be a workout video, too, because a lot of people use it at home to work out. Is a definitely will get you moving.
You already know. You already know. You already know. Ooh.
Now, not to get personal here, but like I don't have much of a butt.
Everyone has a butt, no matter what size it is, you can work it. That's my motto.
No, you think anyone can do it?
Anyone can do it. I've saw this the skinniest girl to the biggest girl do it, as well as the guy, and everyone can do it.
You know, when I talk to people about Big Frida, about yourself, they say, oh, you have to see her live. It's all about seeing her live, which is great, but where does the music go from here? Do you have to convert people sort of one fan at a time, one show at a time?
I don't say it'd be one at a time because people who come to the show, they'll bring their friends and they come in numbers. So I'm picking up a dozen of fans at a time, yes.
But that's a lot of hard work rather than shipping out CDs to every radio station in the country.
That's why I'm the hardest working girl in Bounce Music.
I don't deny it. Big Frida the Queen Diva is on tour, coming to a town near you. She also has a documentary coming out about her life and a dance instruction DVD, so you too can bounce in your own home.
Yes.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I love the way you dance. I love the way you bounce. I love the way you bounce.
Very nicely done. And we didn't have to use the terms caboose, tush, derriere, or fanny. Fanny? Okay. Would you use fanny?
No, that's like a fanny pack. Why would I use fanny? They be having the fanny packs in the front. I wouldn't use fanny at all.
Derriere, that's, you've got the French thing with New Orleans?
Like, yeah.
Derriere,
that's
maybe?
Beyonce, though. Derriere.
Oh, Beyonce owns Derriere.
Yes.
She'll sue you if you use that.
Exactly.
Sorry. I was out dancing. I just want to let the music play a little bit. This is the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. Hope you liked it. The staff that put this together, they are marvelous. They treated me very well. I was down from New York City hosting just this one weekend. They include Lily Percy, Amy Held, Acacia Squires, Liz Baker, and Chris Connolly. Our interns are Annie Russell and Rachel Rude. Shula Newman, love her. She edited the show. And the technical director is Rob Berman. And Steve Lichtai, he's the guy who invited me, our senior producer. I'm Robert Smith. We'll be back next week on the podcast, where you will hear some other host and some other list of favorite stories, but I'm sure they'll be great. And of course, you can always hear us on that old-fashioned radio. We're on every weekend, Saturday and Sunday. Thanks for tuning in. Isn't that hilarious? Thanks for tuning in. They actually wrote that here. It's a podcast, and they put, thanks for tuning in. You already know.